Horizon.
Hello, welcome to Great Failed Prototypes of Our Time. Number 14, the first condom. Oh, come on, cheer up, let's dance.
Tony Slattery was one of the most successful TV comedians of the late 80s and early 90s. Everyone knew his face. But no one's really seen him for 25 years. Withdrawn from the world, he's battled with depression, drugs, and alcohol. Now, as he turns 60, he's back on tour with a show about his life and his inner demons.
The legend is Mr. Tony Slattery.
Mental illness is a highly democratic disease. It can hit anyone. No one in their right mind decides to be mentally ill.
But Tony's never properly understood what's going on in his head because he's never been given a definitive diagnosis. So he's decided it's time to finally have his mental health assessed and try to make sense of the way he feels.
A diagnosis is not easy, and it is a puzzle, and this is why I want to help try and get to the bottom of it, not just for me, but for anyone else who suffers.
Is there anything in his past that could have contributed to his difficulties? What impact is it having on those closest to him?
It's tiring caring for someone, loving someone who is constantly on the edge, really.
And nearly a quarter of a century since he hid himself from view, can modern psychiatry finally provide Tony with some answers?
It's a very serious face.
I can't help it. I'm a very serious person.
What's the matter with Tony Slattery?
In our lifetime, one in four of us will have an issue with our mental health. Identifying a specific condition is never easy. Drink, drugs, and stress can all mask the underlying cause. And the longer it goes untreated, the worse the symptoms may become.
Where do you live, Tony?
I live in a two-up, two-down Widmark terrace house, which is rented with Molly, the psychotic cat.
Mind the brush.
Oh, ow. Hi. Mark, what are you doing here?
Are we doing this seriously? Or
we are.
Okay.
Mark beams as they take a seat on the sofa.
Hello. No excuse for looking like this, is there? I mean, really.
How would you describe your 32 years together?
I think we didn't realise it, but when we first started courting each other, it was a wonderful time, and I think we were viewed as a golden couple, really, because Tony was incredibly popular, working non-stop, and I was going from show to show and sort of busy working as a dancer does and enjoying
and,
all the
and,
jobs
and
I
a singer and an actor, the triple threat, which is what you have to be.
And loving jobs. And Tony came to sort of support me in all my jobs and whenever I was doing something new.
That's good, Sam Barbara Carter, but I don't think we'd be without each other. And I love you.
And I love you.
Thank you.
We're both touched by the same sort of things. We'll hear a piece of music and it'll make us want to cry, or we'll see a film and we'll both think, that was perfect, that was beautiful. And it's great to share those simple things with the person you love.
The couple met in the 80s when Tony was at the peak of his success.
An ordinary house, an ordinary couple, but this is no ordinary drinks maker.
He made his name with the Cambridge Footlights and was renowned for his boundless energy, quick wit, and talent for improv. Channel 4's Whose Line Is It Anyway, with its weekly audience of 6 million people, made him a star.
in the event of Rambo's biceps exploding, his liver and most of his internal visceral organs will be situated there, there, and there.
From panel shows to quiz shows.
Take two bottles into the shower, I won't. Your Royal Highness, my lords, ladies and gentlemen.
Award ceremonies to adverts. Tony was everywhere.
And you never know when you're going to go, do you?
Then, just as suddenly as he appeared, he disappeared, leaving fans to wonder where he'd gone.
How would you describe what happened to you?
I think the overwork came first.
First of all, can I just say that although I am a bloodthirsty, merciless, psychotic warrior, I'm also very much a woman.
I think there was always a manic part of me. There was always a predisposition to mood swings. Then came the being on telly a lot and being in theatre and having people laugh at you and trying to entertain. Too much booze, doing drugs. I think that's partly it. I rented this stupid, huge luxury warehouse overlooking the Thames, but I was so nutty, I threw loads of stuff into the Thames and used to stay up for 4 days. And then the paranoia, I thought everything was bugged and I became obsessed with electrical equipment and chucked it all into Thames. And there was one particular time when the river police came by with a megaphone and they shouted, Tony, we like you in Whose Line Is It Anyway, but please stop chucking things into the Thames.
Why?
2 seconds.
I'd have to try and talk him down. And he kept imagining that he was being spied on, people were breaking into the apartment, and people were destroying things. It became apparent that he was becoming a danger to himself and needed help.
My grip on time and how it passes, that became very fuzzy. And then I think I just got bloody exhausted and withdrew.
Since he dropped out of sight, Tony has suffered prolonged bouts of depression. At one time, he was addicted to cocaine. Since then, he's become a heavy drinker.
His mood is brighter over the past couple of years because he's been busier. But there was a long period where he was very bored, very isolated, didn't want to go out. All he would do is watch TV practically all day long, and his mood would be very low.
He's taken antidepressants for 15 years with varying degrees of success. But Mark has long suspected something other than depression is at play.
I think there's a lot of anger. I think there's a lot of unhappiness. I don't know whether it's specifically from his childhood past or whether it's something that he sort of has worked himself into over the years through whatever reasons. Yes, it's tiring, caring for someone, loving someone who is constantly on the edge, really.
Alcohol is still an ongoing concern. There's no question about that, is there?
No.
No, he said briefly and with great honesty, and it's true. But where that comes from, I don't know. That's why I'd like to find out.
It's been suggested Tony might be bipolar, a condition characterised by dramatic shifts in mood and energy. But living without a diagnosis means he's never had access to the right treatment and never really had a chance of getting better. And his drinking complicates things yet further.
Bye-bye, Molly.
Whilst Tony has agreed to allow everything he discovers to be filmed,
you grateless feline,
he's nervous about letting new people inside his head.
Okay.
Okay, let's go. Follow you, Tony.
Okay.
He decides to reach out to an old friend who's fought his own very public battle with his mental health.
When I first met Tony, I just was instantly charmed by him. And he seemed so talented. And he was. He had a physical presence, and he's handsome, and likeable, and smiley, you know, and those are the things you value in people when you first meet them. There's a lot of love for Tony, and rightly so. you know? He doesn't have a malevolent bone in his body. Tony Slattery. If ever I saw a Tony Slattery... How are you, darling thing?
Oh, lovely to see you.
It's gorgeous to see you as well. How the hell are you?
Not too bad, thanks.
Good, eh?
Thank you so much for coming along.
It's a pleasure. You know, I would walk 1,000 miles in tight shoes over broken glass to please you.
Likewise. This has always been the case.
I might have exaggerated. But either the broken glass or the tight shoes, but not both. You did go through some very dark and difficult passages in life. I think one of the things people overlook is the pain. It's so hard to communicate. Because everybody has bad days, of course they do. But that's different from a pain inside that is so intense and so permanent sometimes. It's kind of a background agony that just has to be dealt with. And unfortunately, the ways people deal with it, if they're not diagnosed, are all dangerous. They're all drugs or alcohol or self-harm of one kind or another. And so the only way to deal with it that isn't dangerous is to rely on the health service.
No one in their right mind wants to be depressed, chooses to be depressed.
I had a particularly terrible episode, and so I then submitted to a doctor. He told me that if I carried on the way I was without treatment, I was very likely to die a bit before my time. You have to try and believe that it's an adventure, almost like an intellectual challenge. I'm going to see if I can take this beast out of myself and anatomize it on a table and deal with it. Does that make sense?
Stephen, thank you. Thank you so much.
It has been a joy talking to you. Give me a kiss.
I'd like to get back into real life as opposed to this period of, I guess you could say, self-indulgence, stasis and withdrawal and interiority, because apart from anything else, nothing gets done.
Though Tony's history of heightened energy coupled with bouts of depression could point towards him being bipolar, saying for sure won't be easy. Most people are misdiagnosed 3 times before the disorder can finally be identified. His first step is to see his former GP, Dr. Gaynor, the man who initially spotted his depression 25 years ago.
How would you describe some of his issues?
Complex, really. I would say it's a combination of depression with an overlay of alcohol and substance abuse, really.
Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
When you have substance abuse, which could be alcohol and other drugs, it shields quite a lot of the underlying pathologies.
I use the antidepressant to keep the bleakness at bay. It's a bit of a. It still remains a puzzle.
And there are sometimes that Tony decides he doesn't want to take antidepressants, so he stops all of them completely.
Right.
And that causes some set of problems because his behaviour gets very sort of very erratic then.
There's a bit of me which wants to feel what is life like without them?
Dreadful.
Yes.
I think you have to view this a bit like being a diabetic, and they can't do without their insulin in the same way you can't do without your antidepressant medication. What about cocaine abuse? When did you last use cocaine?
Last, I think it was around the millennium.
Really?
It really was. Yeah. And
so what's the status now with alcohol?
I still drink too much. I'm not sure about the units, but it...
I don't know where the alcohol ends and the depression starts. And I don't sort of... I would like one to give way to the other so that they could be addressed properly.
I've got letters from 3 psychiatrists here. They don't know either. So nobody's actually formally come up with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, although they've been suspicious of it. This question of getting to the bottom of it, I think, is really important. And there is a Dr. Guy Goodwin, who is a specialist in this whole field, and I think I'd rather like you to see him
OK.
But before we say goodbye, I was looking through the records, Tony.
No, I don't.
Now, can you tell me about this? It says, please lower my dosage. Tony Slattery. So what was that about, Tony?
That was my spotlight photo for a year. I didn't get much work that day.
All I can say is that they're all treasures, and they will live with your notes.
Share those to the psychiatrists.
No, I'll keep them. Yeah. You go and see Dr. Griffin.
Okay.
And then he'll write me back a letter and tell me what his views are and what we should do next.
Thank you.
That's enough.
Bye.
Mark and Tony leave the building and head out onto the street beyond.
This way, yeah.
Oxford from above on a bright day.
Guy Goodwin is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Oxford. He's the world's leading authority on bipolar disorder, and he's been pioneering treatment for 30 years. Getting a diagnosis requires establishing a history of episodes of both major depression and mood elevation, where a person feels very high and is physically overactive.
Well, I think the main difficulty has been that simply the right questions are not asked of people when they come complaining, say, of anxiety or depression. And the consequence of that is that they may get treated for what the doctor sees, it's often the GP, but they miss the diagnosis as actually lurking there, which is one of bipolar disorder.
People tend not to see feeling high as a problem. So if all a doctor hears is talk of depression, misdiagnosis is not uncommon.
Looking back at Tony's performance history, his act really was based on his exuberance and his high spirits and his speed of thought. And all of those things are, if you like, related to mood elevation. Anyone with this kind of history, there's a possibility that he is on this bipolar spectrum. And we think that the longer people remain undiagnosed and untreated, the more persistent the symptoms may become.
Bipolar disorder used to be called manic depression, but it's now understood as a spectrum. At the most severe end is bipolar 1, which is characterized by periods of extreme mood elevation, often requiring hospital admission. These are known as manic episodes. There are then less severe forms of bipolarity where people fluctuate between shorter depressive episodes and less extreme elevated moods, known as hypomania.
I've known about a dozen different versions of Tony over the years. I know the vodka Tony, I know the paranoia Tony, I know the cocaine Tony, I know the sort of the, just so many Tonys. And it used to get to the point where I used to sort of behave and speak differently to whichever one it was.
Tony and Mark are travelling on an overground train. Next, they join Guy in a consultation room.
Hi. Looking through the notes, the only clue to the possibility of bipolar disorder was Tony's depressive complaint. How am I going to assess the possible bipolarity? Well, that's really to ask him directly about the possibility that he's been manic. So, in the last few weeks, how would you describe your mood?
Up and down and pretty rapid cycling and sort of waking up very anxious and angry, and I've woken up angry for a long time, and then that fades, and then I become very enthusiastic about things, and there can often be a sort of rush of activity, but with no particular productive outcome.
Is there any element of actual pleasure, euphoria, that kind of goes along with this?
Euphoria there is an element of kind of grandiosity about ideas of what I can achieve and my goals, and then that's but then that's followed by a sense of waste and kind of almost sort of collapse, and you think, what am I thinking? This will never be achieved. So that kind of spasm of positivity is replaced by some kind of sort of physical collapse. And said, no, what's the point?
Do you switch very suddenly from feeling that everything's possible to feeling that nothing's possible? Is that
That's what strikes me. It is very sudden.
Right. Okay. So that sort of state of social withdrawal, lack of confidence, inability to make decisions, with disturbed eating, sleeping, that's something that can last, has lasted in your life for up to, you were saying, months, is that right?
Oh, I think it goes, Professor, it goes back longer than months. That's been the case for years.
There are sort of times when I'm sort of, I see Tony and he seems right as rain, and then I'll go out and go to the library or whatever, or go to work and I'll come back, and then it's almost like there's another Tony there. He's sort of morphed into sort of a lethargic, negative.
Growing up, how were you at school?
I remember school as generally a very happy time. I can't remember a time at Cambridge University or during my period of intense work when I was, for a long period, deeply detached or unhappy.
You were mainly pretty hyperthymic, as we would say. You were usually sunny, active, energetic, confident, and that ran on pretty much as your normal mood. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you think you've had sustained periods of elevation when you were a bit out of the box for long periods of time?
Yes, Professor, they have, but I think they might be connected with comorbidity of substance abuse.
Yeah. Where did the drug use come from?
I often used to take it entirely on my own, often watching a television which was deliberately tuned to a channel which didn't exist.
I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but were you trying to treat something? I mean, were you trying to get a mental state that you preferred to the one that you normally had? How did it work for you?
I tend to put things to one side and ignore things, even when they might be serious. I think, but oddly, I think cocaine was actually numbing me instead of exciting me.
But though his actions whilst on drugs sound extreme, it doesn't necessarily mean Tony is on the bipolar spectrum.
Bipolar 1 disorder is characterised by mania. He was not manic, he was not overactive, he wasn't overconfident. He wasn't doing all the things that we associate with a manic picture. But we can say that he was hyperthymic, that he had a mood that tended to be higher, more exuberant, more demonstrative than the average person. And that, of course, was the quality that made him the performer that he was.
Bipolar 1 now excluded, to work out if Tony does sit on the spectrum, Professor Goodwin needs to find evidence his moods still fluctuate between depressed and hypothymic. So he decides to try him out on a brand new diagnostic tool he's developing, a digital mood diary.
So, Tony, you've linked to this from your email, and you'll get a prompt twice a day for the next month. What you'll find is that it'll say, I think, your task.
Yep, a task is due to be completed today.
Exactly. You just click on the appropriate button there to get into the task.
Oh, okay. Oh, gosh.
What this is asking you is just to say best ever, worst ever, so 0 to 7.
Right.
On each of those items. And it's just how you're feeling now.
The middle, elated, I would say not at all. Sad, again, the middle, angry. Sorry, I'm going to go for very much because I always wake up angry.
So that's good. Just exactly how you feel at this minute.
Okay.
The idea is that we're trying trying to look at your variable mood and get us a measure of it, which may be useful for both of us to look at.
Got it. Okay.
And if we do that twice a day for the next month, A, you'll be sick of the sight of it, but B, we'll have some interesting data on just how much your mood varies and how it, most importantly, how it varies, what the pattern is.
Okay.
But whilst Professor Goodwin is hoping to identify trends in Tony's moods, one key factor massively complicates the way he feels day to day. Alcohol.
You can't see the wood for the trees. You don't know what to prioritise or what to sort of treat first, because it's all interwoven. And it's terribly hard to think, is this because of the alcohol or is this the depression? I mean, I have run away a couple of times. I go away for a week and run away to my brothers in Liverpool. I think everybody needs a bit of respite, unfortunately. But I hate being away from him.
Tony frowns as he sways back and forth.
So I'm conscious that I'm swaying now. It's not helping you, is it? I'm swaying.
It's not unusual for people suspected of being bipolar to also drink heavily, masking their symptoms.
I love him. I would describe myself as a professional optimist, because if I'm not contracting him, then I would sink as well. And I can't do that. I can't sink because, you know, I have to keep him afloat. And it's hard.
Tony seems to be about to say something, but struggles.
Is drinking with you in your control?
I want it to be, and that's the honest answer. I want it to be.
But it's still rattling around in there, the idea that eventually you would like to sort of cut back immensely the amount of alcohol.
I wouldn't say it was rattling, I said it was churning.
Okay. It doesn't make you happy drinking, though, does it, Jerry? The things that happen are generally negative after you've been drinking, and it doesn't bring much richness or any warmth into your life, really, does it?
Tony takes this in.
Well, no.
Cut back on the alcohol so we can concentrate on finding out more about the depression, the bipolarity, and start to sort of find out how that can be addressed and lived with. I've got your back, sweetheart, but sometimes I need you to be strong and have my back. Yeah. And you know what I'm saying.
Mark's clutching Tony's hand and has kissed it, while tears glisten on Tony's cheek.
Because I miss you.
The cat is sunning itself by a window while Mark rests his cheek against his and Tony's hand.
30% of patients with bipolar disorder also use alcohol and drugs to excess. And that means that it's got to be present in your mind that the two things may be there. On the other hand, the fact that people are using alcohol and drugs may obscure what you can observe and what you can conclude. I think it's quite important to get a specialist opinion of just how severe this is.
On a train.
Tony's on his way to see Professor Julia Sinclair, an addiction psychiatrist at the University of Southampton. He has tried to quit drinking before. He's been to 3 rehab centres, all without success. And after a recent attempt to go cold turkey, he ended up in hospital, the alcohol withdrawal triggering a seizure, which may have caused some brain damage. It's made him scared of trying again.
Standing in an office, Tony looks agitated and opens a small cupboard.
Yeah. I didn't look. Oh, that's bad. I thought it might have been a mini bar. That's bad. I did think that.
Standing, he turns on the spot before sitting down.
I want Julia's authority in this particular assessment because she is used to seeing a lot of people with the combination of mood disorder and alcohol use. And she is also someone who is used to producing the kind of motivational statement that might enable someone to turn a corner.
Tony.
Oh, Julia.
Hi, good to meet you.
Pleased to meet you.
Come on through. Do you want to go down to my room? Bring your water. Yeah.
It is. It's actually Vimto.
No, I remember Vimto.
You can try it.
No. I remember Vimto. I used to really like Vimto. Come on through. What, at the moment, is your aim with regard your drinking?
He takes a deep breath.
I'd like not to be to be dependent and to be a slave to these impulses, these cravings, psychological, physical. That's what I would like.
Yeah. Can you remember, when did you last have a day where you drank nothing at all? Weeks, months, years?
I think it... I think it will be years.
Okay. Do you see yourself as being completely alcohol-free?
The only point of this, I guess, is for me to be true. I can't imagine it.
Yeah.
Even though I really want to, I just can't imagine it.
Yeah. And many people I see would say that. What, from your point of view, makes it so impossible at the moment?
I guess I've been doing it for so long. It's hard to think of a time without it. What would life feel like?
Yeah.
What would life feel like without the blunting effects? And you see the bleakness of life for what it really is.
Or the beauty of it.
Or the beauty of it, yes. There's that other side, yes.
In the past, I understand you used to use some cocaine. When was the first time you ever used cocaine?
I think it was in the early 90s.
Okay, yeah.
The heavy drinking started as a kind of sort of self-medication to bring me down from the cocaine. And I stopped taking it in the millennium.
So about a 10-year history of cocaine
was,
use.
Yes.
And what was your maximum use?
10
period?
Grams a day.
About 10 grams a day. Okay, and how long were
lot,
you...
Quite a lot, isn't it?
Fair amount. What made you decide to stop the cocaine?
I found out what I was taking.
Right.
Which is very impure.
Okay. Just stopped?
Yes.
And how was that as an experience?
It was interesting because I've never missed it.
Okay.
Since.
So I'm just wondering, though, that you were able to do that with the cocaine, is kind of say, actually, I'm not prepared for that thing to make me...
Yes.
This person I don't like being, but you haven't yet quite reached that stage with the alcohol.
No.
I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
I never thought of it like that, but so I did it.
You got form, mate.
Okay.
Oh, I'm serious.
I never thought, what can I do with this then? I do that. My partner says this a lot. Why do you overthink things so much? And Mark once said to me, he said, all this thinking, Tony, I think you've got quite a big mind, but wouldn't it be better if you did the hoovering and the washing up? And that kind of... Put it in perspective, really, just now.
Yeah. You're enslaved, I think, was the phrase that you use. You're enslaved by the drink. And it's about starting to turn that round so that you can start to think, well, maybe I could have a day without alcohol. It's not going to happen overnight, but actually we change our thoughts by doing things rather than changing what we do by thinking things. Monitoring alcohol, you know, it's one of the most effective behaviour change tools. You know, this is why Fitbits work. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes complete sense, the way you've put it.
Its simplicity is what actually makes it doable.
Tony nods and next is on a train once more.
Julia confirmed our impression that the drinking was a pretty central problem for Tony. She was particularly impressed by the fact that Tony was able to simply stop taking cocaine. And I think it's certainly encouraging to look back on that and to think about how able he was to make that complete switch in behaviour. It's going to be important for me to try and reinforce that message.
A city at night time and rain-soaked streets.
Tony's comeback show, where he's interviewed on stage about his life, has reached Belfast.
And I've still got my own teeth. Well, no, I haven't actually. Robert, they're yours. Please, no, take them back. No, I insist.
You can borrow them for the show, it's fine.
All right.
How are you feeling about tonight?
The thing is, I'm really looking forward to it.
How are you actually feeling today in yourself?
In myself, I'm feeling good because I had breakfast. I ate food.
And do you mind me asking how?
Yes.
Why did you want to eat breakfast?
I fancied having breakfast with Mark and getting up and eating, and I think a sense of normality. Oh God, how are you feeling? Okay.
He's keen to record this elevated mood in his digital diary.
Anxious, right. From not at all to very much. I'm going to say... Do you know, I'm going to say not at all. Angry, not at all. Irritable, not at all. Energetic.
I think these are already positive. Energetic is positive, so...
Tony playfully taps the tablet screen.
It's good when he's busy and engaged. Yeah. And, yeah, enjoying Belfast, and he's just sort of happy and sort of content today. He hasn't had that much to drink at all, really, which is good.
I don't know if you can see... Robert, can you see what I'm doing?
He can cope far better than he thinks without it. And if he's busy or he's doing things, he doesn't realise that he's not drinking. His mood is improving. That's great, but... You can't make Tony do anything. He has what to do it himself. So, we shall see.
He's been cleaning the floor, then pretends to collapse.
It's my absolute pleasure to introduce two of my dearest, closest friends. Please welcome to the stage film historian Robert J. E. Simpson and the comedy legend that is Mr. Tony Slattery.
Tony takes a bow as he steps onto the stage, then drops heavily into a small leather sofa.
That's it, he's not getting up now for the rest of the night.
No. These armchairs are really low. I was thinking of a kind of a riff on a ditty where you dust yourself up, brush yourself down, and start taking more Prozac and blame someone else. Which is what often happens.
That's not what you do, though.
No.
What do you do?
I blame myself.
You blame yourself.
Ever true to his improv roots, Tony doesn't like to plan what he says in advance.
I think religion is really good if it makes people kind and behave nicely.
And conversation in these shows often turns to his past.
my teachers, nuns and priests, and they were good and bad.
There was a story you told. The one about the nun that hit you in the head.
Because the nun.
Why did she hit you?
You had to stand up and say the Lord's Prayer, and I did with reverence and respect, but I got it wrong. On that day, I said, Our Father, who art in heaven, how are you, by the way? I just got it wrong, and she just raged up to it. She'd blaspheme!
Genetics and the environment are usually seen as contributing factors in the development of bipolar. But it's been discovered that trauma can play a significant role too. A recent study found that people with the disorder are 2.5 times more likely to have suffered some kind of traumatic event in their youth. And occasionally, both on stage and in interviews, Tony has referenced a troubling experience in his own past.
Can we all shift around a wee bit?
Ouch. There's a man called Dr. Mate. He talks a lot about addiction being a loss of connection with our real self, our child, if you like. That it's a sort of symptom, you know, it's a reaching out for something to cope with something that happened that we couldn't deal with when we were young.
To retrace the thread of time, which goes back to perhaps traumatic childhood events. But then the decision is whether to leave that baggage on your shoulder or just shift it off.
If you can. Mm-hmm.
If you can, exactly.
Yeah. And you've decided what? To shift it off? Not talk about it? Or pack it away and sort of walk around it?
Well, I think...
Looking back to his childhood, there was an incident that he's touched on. I think that's been bubbling away in his mind for a long, long time. It's lying deep there and needs to be addressed.
What a beautiful day. Wow. And what a beautiful building. Oh, hello, Kieran.
Hello, Tony.
Before leaving Belfast, Tony and Mark decide to consult Professor Kieran Mulholland from Queen's University. He's one of the leading experts in this area of childhood trauma and mental health. Though it's likely to be incredibly intimate, okay. Kieran and Tony both agree to allow for the session to be filmed.
I'm a consultant psychiatrist. I know you've met a number of psychiatrists on your journey in the last few weeks and over the years. Mm-hmm. It was at your show last night, which lasted nearly 2 hours, so I do feel I know quite a lot about you on the basis of that show. Mm-hmm. And I've read...
2 hours, sorry about that.
Oh, it was very good. I really, really enjoyed it. The purpose of this conversation is more to discuss specific issues around trauma.
Okay.
And how trauma might have affected you through your life. And the purpose of this is not just to talk about it for the sake of talking about it, not to relive it, just for the sake of reliving it, the traumatic experiences, I mean, but to try and understand just how important it might be and to try and determine whether a focused therapeutic approach, a talking therapy, might be helpful at this point,
okay.
This point in your life. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
There was the Guardian interview earlier this year, which I read, and you did mention specifically an incident with a priest at the age of eight. So that doesn't sound good, and it's hard.
Might as well cut to the chase.
Yes. It's hard to imagine that could have had anything but a negative impact on your life.
Well, it wasn't pleasant, no. Being fucked up the arse at the age of eight, no, it was not.
Okay, so that's what we're talking about, as bad as that.
Well, that's what happened.
Okay.
Whether that baggage still is on my shoulders at the age of 60, I don't know. Do you shrug off baggage or... I mean, might as well be frank.
Have you ever talked about this before in the way you've just talked about it in the last 2 minutes?
With Mark.
You haven't actually sort of been that specific. You didn't tell your parents?
Well, God, no.
So you kept it secret?
Yes.
It happened more than once, Tony?
Frowning, he searches for the words. He closes his eyes.
Yeah, but I...
Yeah, but I can only remember the first time. Or choose not to try and remember the first time.
Okay.
I've often thought that to blame everything on what happened when I was eight I'm not sure about that.
Okay. There's seldom one single cause for anything. Mm. It's a combination. And sometimes there's something in our genes, in our inheritance, that's important. Clearly using a lot of cocaine was important. But I do wonder if the traumatic experience at the age of eight is perhaps of more importance than everything else, without saying that it explains everything, but of central importance.
Okay. How does one address it? What do you do? Do you put it in a kind of psychological waste paper bin and say, that was then, so what?
No, I think what you do is you address it with modern forms of therapy, which are very focused.
Not something I've talked about until now. I've shelved it. I think for a long time, I think.
You do refer to it more than you think you do sometimes.
Ah.
So I think it is troubling you more than you think, because it serves as when you do conversation, talk shows and things, and you touch on it, but then you sort of go past it. So I think it's there more than you think.
Okay.
Lately, definitely.
Okay. I'm so fucking worried that this is a self-indulgence. Talking about it.
Well, it's definitely not. Yeah. That's not the case, I don't think. I don't think that. Mark doesn't think that. It's not the case, Tony.
It's about your well-being and your happiness.
I think the very fact that you think that and you feel guilty is a reflection of what's happened. It's caused by that.
From all those years ago?
From all those years ago.
Jesus.
It's quite likely you've carried guilt with you ever since. In quite a profound way, which has meant that you've been quite self-destructive, as opposed to self-indulgent. As well as what happened in the past, address the present and being in a healthier place, which will allow you to go forward. But at some point, you have to take the first step on that journey. Maybe it's now. There is a way forward.
Okay.
And so you need to believe, first of all, that it's necessary, and then believe that it's possible.
Oh.
You know, I want to do something, I believe there is something that can be done.
Ah.
Does that sound like a problem?
No, it's just never been put to me like that before. Ha, thank you. Yeah.
Mark and Tony walk away together.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I don't know. It's stuff. Came up. Long time coming. I don't know. Is it?
A blue sky, then the view from an aeroplane.
We're not sure what happens in the brain of patients who have experienced early abuse, but we know that people with histories of trauma up to the teenage years show a different response to stress later on in life. Sexual abuse obviously plays a part in Tony's story. It's common for people to be slow to disclose sexual abuse and to, in a sense, not want to cover it, not want to address it. It sometimes seems like people need to do that before they can move on.
Now that Tony has opened up about his abuse, for the first time, trauma-focused therapy becomes an option for him.
I was relieved that he'd actually confronted it and sort of said, this happened to me, and it upset him, obviously. But I find it very sort of, I was glad he did it, and I hope it, he carries on sort of, getting rid of these demons and freeing himself from these things in his head.
But as the days and weeks pass, Tony continues to struggle with his mood.
Hey, Tony, hello.
Oh, hello, Professor Guy. Thank you for talking to me.
You're not getting on very well with the self-rating things that are pinged to you every day. Because they ping me when you haven't done it, you see. So I've got a lot of messages in my inbox. Almost as many as you, I think.
That makes me feel very guilty.
He rubs his head.
Sorry, and this, I know this is oxymoronic. I've been a bit too low to do it, and that's an insult to you, and I'm sorry.
No, not at all. No, I mean, I'm curious just to know whether we can make it any easier, because, you know, obviously it's supposed to be a relatively straightforward thing to do, and it isn't turning out to be.
It's the gradations between are you sad and are you happy. It's not that I can't properly answer them. I'm sorry.
Tony and Mark are at home.
Professor Goodwin decides the time is right to bring Tony and Mark back in to go through his findings.
I'm so used to sort of living with a certain level of stress and anxiety that I've grown accustomed to it in a way. There were moments I didn't realise weren't normal. I just thought, oh, Tony's having a bad day, or he's in a bad mood, or... But looking back, I think it's clear that he's more complicated.
Cup of tea for you. I think to reveal oneself and one's own experiences can easily, I know, come across as so self-regarding, but what if it bloody helps someone else?
At home, Tony pulls on his coat.
Uncovering his childhood trauma and realising he has the mental strength to overcome addiction have been major breakthroughs. But there is one factor preventing progress that only Tony himself has the power to overcome.
Mark and Tony are on a train again.
Hey, Tony. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to see you. Do take a seat. How central do you think alcohol is to the problems you've had over the last 20 years?
I think it's really important.
And what's the solution, Tony?
The solution is to overcome... One, to stop drinking.
Mark is also in the room and studies Tony, who once again is finding it difficult to vocalise his thoughts.
Or maybe it's just numbing things which are there.
That's a bit of a let-out clause, isn't it, to say it's numbing things. So that's sort of saying that other things are the problem and that alcohol's the solution.
Yes.
I mean, our experience and the experience of people like Julia Sinclair is that it's almost always the other way around, and that alcohol is the problem, and the solution is not to use it. And how you chart your route to that is always personal and something other people can't do for you. I mean, you don't have bipolar 1 disorder because you've never had mania, and hypermania is more difficult to judge. You certainly had elation, you certainly experienced, and your personality is bubbly and tends to run on the high side when it's good. Those things are probably put you on this sort of bipolar spectrum. But managing mood is therefore perhaps always going to be a challenge, but it's made more difficult if one is excessively drinking alcohol. You've got the potential for many positive things to happen if you didn't drink. Many people don't have all those positive things. They don't have positive people in their lives. They don't have a personality, a profession that they can still practice. And you do. And the final thing is, you know, you will find out just how much the mood instability and so on is screwed up by alcohol if you stop taking it, and how much better you might feel. No promises, but how much better you might feel if you stopped. And all I can do is try and give you the motivation to do it yourself, because I can't do it for you. Mark can't do it for you. In fact, nobody can.
Frowning, Tony takes this in, then nods.
Tony, Professor Goodwin, thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks, and we might meet again.
If he were able to stop drinking, then it seems to me that one could then seriously look at how far his mood disorder and the evidence that he's had this abuse in the past could be addressed. But at the moment, it seems to me that the alcohol hangs over everything else and it prevents him moving on these other issues.
Dr. Goodwin thinks it likely that Tony, just like 3 million other people in this country, does sit on the bipolar spectrum. Everyone's circumstances are different, and our understanding of the disorder is still in its infancy. Medication can be used to stabilize mood to minimize manic and depressive episodes, but on average, it takes 10 years to get an accurate diagnosis of bipolar in the first place.
It actually has made me contemplate and meditate, but not in so much a navel-gazing, self-absorbed way, but thinking, hang on, we've only got one life, and, I'd like to cut down and eventually give up the booze. I'd like to get work, I'd like to have an agent, I'd like to make people laugh or entertain or do things which are serious, because I think my life's been, as many people's lives are, in a state of stasis for so long, and some of that has been my fault and some of it has been rather beyond my control. So they're the thoughts which today has induced. Yeah.
In the months since his assessment, Tony has managed to reduce his drinking. There's a long way to go, but this is more progress than he's managed in years.
I hope he'll stay in a better frame of mind and it'll be a step up from where we've been for such a long time, and hopefully that step up will lead to another step up.
Change is afoot.
Yes. It is, definitely.
Have you done any hoovering recently? Do you plan to?
It's an ambition.